competition monopoly, it's kind of a big topic. I'm going to talk about the Austrian view of competition and monopoly. And I guess I might as well put an Austrian definition of competition on the board. And what I'm going to have to say is from about the time of Adam Smith on until about the 1930s, almost anybody who wrote on the topic of competition, any scholar, wrote of it like the Austrians do, and like the Austrians did. And this is my Austrian definition. This is not from von Mises or anybody. I guess you can kind of see it. And competition is a dynamic, rivalrous process of discovery and entrepreneurship that coordinates the plans of market participants. That's a definition, the Austrian definition of competition. And, you know, in doing this process involves advertising, product differentiation, price cutting, mergers, innovation, and lots of other business practices that we may have time to talk about here. And so that's a good verbal definition of what the Austrians mean. Competition is ongoing, never ending, never stopping. It's dynamic. What does this mean, discovery process? Well, one of F.A. Hayek's most famous essays is Competition as a Discovery Process. And in a nutshell, one of the things that means is that the way in which business firms learn how best to do business, what the optimal scale of plant is, which business tactics are appropriate, is a merger a good idea or a bad idea? The market tells us that. That is, trial and error in the marketplace is the only way to learn what works best. So the process of the market is what gives us information, what gives business information about how best to go about their business, about how best to maximize their profits. And it's also what gives consumers information about what products they want and don't want and so forth. And on down the line, as you know, workers and other input suppliers, that's how they figure out the best way to go about their business. So the market is a dynamic process of discovery. If you read some of the literature, that's what is meant by discovery. And of course, entrepreneurship, being alert to opportunities that others have not been as alert to in terms of making profits, providing products. And I put together a few suggested readings, just my suggested readings on this. Probably one of my favorite articles on this whole topic is by Hayek himself. It's called The Meaning of Competition, and it's in his book, Individualism and Economic Order, which is for sale downstairs. It's in the library. There are numerous copies right here, right in this very room. And then Murray Rothbard's chapter on monopoly in chapter 10 of Man, Economy, and State is a good thing to read up on in terms of the Austrian view of competition. And then an article of mine, I'll blow my own horn, an article of mine with Jack High called Antitrust and Competition Historically Considered. It was published in an economics journal called Economic Inquiry in 1988, Ancient History. And I'm going to talk about that in a few seconds here. And then a really great book that talks about antitrust regulation and competition and monopoly is Dominic Armentano, who's an old friend of ours. He's an Austrian economist, and the title of the book is Antitrust and Monopoly, Anatomy of a Policy Failure. And so if you want to do some extra reading when you go back home or at any time, those are the ones that I would recommend. Just keep that out there. Now, this definition, as I said, from about the time of Adam Smith on, was the reigning definition, essentially, of what the meaning of competition was. And to impress upon you this point, one of the research projects I did that is involved in this article that I mentioned from Economic Inquiry is my co-author Jack High and I took a look at this issue of why it was that economists at the time of the first antitrust law, it was 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act, were almost unanimously opposed to it. In fact, back in those days, there were really only a couple of dozen people who had full-time jobs as academic economists in the United States. So we were able to survey the entire population of the economics profession. And anybody who wrote anything on the topic of competition and monopoly, we read, and we wrote this paper. And one of the reasons we wrote the paper was that the late George Stigler, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from the University of Chicago, had written a paper on this very topic, and he gave some explanations of why economists came to accept antitrust eventually. One of them was, if I can paraphrase Stigler, they came to learn that they could earn significantly more than the minimum wage as antitrust consultants. And so it was all money. That's why economists came to accept antitrust. But at the time the laws were passed in the late 1880s, there were state laws in the U.S., and 1890 was the first federal law. There was almost unanimous opposition. We found one prominent economist who was in favor of it. Even socialists like Richard T. Ely, who was the co-founder of the American Economic Association, was opposed to antitrust on the grounds that he thought it interfered with competition, and by this definition. So even people who are self-proclaimed socialists still thought of competition in this way. They just didn't like the end results of competition, the socialists. And I'll give you a few examples of what these people were saying. Ely, Richard T. Ely, E-L-Y, the co-founder of the American Economic Association, I think it was 1888, sometime around there. He said, and this was a period of time where there were a lot of mergers, and large-scale production was a relatively new thing in America, you know, mass production. And so some people were saying, well, this is monopoly, large-scale production. Richard T. Ely wrote that, quote, large-scale production is a thing which by no means necessarily signifies monopolized production. The other co-founder of the American Economic Association was John Bates Clark. His name is up here somewhere on the wall. And he said, the notion that industrial combinations would destroy competition should not be too hastily accepted, and he eventually didn't. Back then, the Chicago School was already very prominent, and one of the intellectual leaders of the Chicago School back in those days was a man named Herbert Davenport, an economist. And he said, where there are only a few firms in an industry where there are economies of scale, it does not require the elimination of competition. Irving Fisher, famous Irving Fisher, who's probably associated with the Chicago School as much as anybody, said that large-scale production produced competitive benefits through cost savings in advertising, selling, and less cross-shipping, he said. And so that's enough quotations from there. But all of the economists we surveyed said things like this. They said, wait a minute, this new antitrust law or anti-monopoly law is being passed is actually inherently incompatible with competition, because competition is what? It's a dynamic, rivalrous process of entrepreneurship, and the purpose of this law apparently was just to stop that process in the name of, we're afraid of bigness. We're afraid of the companies that get too big. And so they were all Austrians. I guess you could have said we're all Austrians now in those days in terms of thinking about competition. That all changed by around the 1920s and 1930s as a result of the decision by some of the top people in the economics profession to try to imitate the physical sciences and make economics much more mathematical based. Based on mathematical models as opposed to the types of studies of industry that these men that I just quoted did in their research. And so in order to be able to mathematically model markets, you needed to adopt not only positivism, but the whole apparatus of scientism and scientific modeling. And so the definition of competition had to change because you can't model this with mathematics. You can't model entrepreneurship. Just look at any economics textbook, any principles of economics textbook, and look up the index and see if the word entrepreneurship is there. And a lot of them is not even there. And if it is, it's usually a page or two just mentions that, well, there is such a thing as entrepreneurship, and that's about it. They won't even mention it. But to the Austrians, this is the essential ingredient of the entire process of competition. This is what drives it. And so that was wiped out. That was forgotten in the newer definitions. And, of course, the newer definition turned out to be the one that you're all familiar with that's in all the textbooks still to this day. So by the 1930s, competition came to mean perfect competition. This was the perfect competition model. And the basic assumptions, there are a few other ones in some of the textbooks of this time, but the basic assumptions were, in order for competition to be perfect, or pure, as it is sometimes said, we need many firms producing homogeneous products. They all produce the same thing. Homogeneous prices, all equal to marginal cost. Perfect information is also an assumption of the model. And costless entry and exit. And of course, every one of these is totally unrealistic in terms of real-world competition. But the idea was they wanted to model price competition, only price competition. And so we're going to assume away all other types of competition, which this does. Because the purpose of this model, which I assume just about everybody here has seen in a textbook form somewhere, was primarily to have a model of price competition. And that's what the perfect competition model does. And so the intent really was as a modeling device. It was never intended that these assumptions were to be taken seriously as somebody, for example, by policymakers that would say, aha, homogeneous products don't exist in real estate. You know, pick any market. Therefore, it's monopolistic. Therefore, the government needs to regulate real estate because it's a monopoly. And of course, you know, no market has homogeneous products. Every market has products that are different. If not physically, they're different as they are perceived by many consumers. Even something like car tires. You could have a Michelin car tire that is physically identical to a Goodyear car tire, but people will have different opinions of the quality of that tire depending on their experiences and their knowledge about a lot of things, not just the tire itself, but the service they get from the Michelin company versus the Goodyear company and so forth. So even products that are physically similar, people can have different perceptions because of advertising and experience and word of mouth, what their friends and neighbors say about the products. So the perception can be different as far as that goes. So what was the consequence of this? What was this transformation? I have a few more quotes. I don't know if you can read this or not. This is from Hayek himself. In this essay that I mentioned, well, it's a little too dark, too light up here for you to see it. Maybe the people in the front row can see it, but it's better than nothing anyway. These are the privileged, by the way, the privileged students in the front row. But this is a passage from the essay, The Meaning of Competition. The peculiar nature of the assumptions from which the theory of competitive equilibrium starts stands out very clearly if we ask which of the activities that are commonly designated by the verb to compete would still be possible if those conditions were all satisfied. Perhaps it is worth recalling that, according to Dr. Johnson, competition is the action of endeavoring to gain what another endeavors to gain at the same time. Now, how many of the devices adopted in ordinary life to that end would still be open to a seller in a market in which so-called perfect competition prevails? I believe that the answer is exactly none. Advertising, price undercutting, and improving or differentiating the goods or services produced are all excluded by definition. Perfect competition means indeed the absence of all competitive activities. And he was exactly right about that. And so there is no competition. And so beginning in the 1930s, this markets didn't change, but the economist's definition of markets changed. So all of a sudden, there was this thinking that there's monopoly everywhere. And this type of thinking also led to quite a revolution in economics, the monopolistic competition revolution, where Joan Robinson was an economist, and a British economist whose name is most associated with monopolistic competition, and another British economist named Edward Chamberlain. They basically wrote the same book in the 1930s on so-called monopolistic competition. And they basically said, well, yes, we do have most industries. If you look around, there are many firms that want to assume many firms. But they all produce something that's a little bit different. And so by virtue of differentiating your product, everything is a monopoly because no two products are identical. And even if they are identical physically, they're not identical by perception, how the consumers perceive them necessarily. So even the perception of differences causes monopoly everywhere because it creates a unique single product that is unique from all other products. And so we went from the study of markets, where the economists who thought of markets like the Austrians do, as not being concerned about all these mergers and things that were, and all the changes that were going on, to a transformation in the definition of competition, and the addition of this idea of monopolistic competition, pretty much condemning capitalism as being one big collection of monopolies everywhere that were in need of central planning and regulation and regimentation, lest they exploit the consumers. So product differentiation itself became the enemy. It became a cause of monopoly under this definition. And this was taught to generations of students. I have here, the print is way too small here. I'm not going to try to even get the front row to read this, I don't think. But this is a page from the biggest selling economics textbook of the 20th century. It was Paul Samuelson's book, Economics, Principles of Economics. And it was first published in 1948, and for the next 40 years was by far the biggest seller, sold something like 4 million copies. And not only that, but almost every other Principles of Economics book that existed was an imitation of Samuelson. And so the whole economics profession adopted the Samuelson approach to teaching economics, except for the Austrians. They never adopted this crap here. But the rest of the place did. And so in the chapter on competition, if you read what Samuelson is saying, he gives a definition. He says, a perfect competitor is one who can sell all he wishes at the going market price, but is unable to raise or depress the market price. And by definition, a perfectly competitive industry is one made up exclusively of numerous perfect competitors. In all likelihood, it has some kind of organized auction mechanism. And he said, well, since we don't see many auctions, you know, when you go to buy bread and milk, there's not an auction anywhere. He says, well, therefore, perfect competition exists almost nowhere because there's no auctions. You know, we have cattle auctions and things like that, but, not much. And so he has a list of commodities. And he says, think of these commodities. Which ones of these fit in the definition of competition? So he puts together a long list of commodities, and he concludes that you'll find that only potatoes, tobacco, wheat, and cotton come within our strict definition of perfect competition. So generations of college students were taught that everything is monopolistic except for potatoes, tobacco, wheat, and cotton. Because, you know, a potato is a potato. It's homogeneous. It looks just like all the other potatoes. And so cotton is cotton. The bale of cotton here is the same as that bale of cotton. Homogeneous. That fits in our definition. Even that was wrong. Even that was wrong because of agricultural policy. You know, at the time, this was 1958, fourth edition of Samuelson. At the time, we had all these agricultural policies that paid farmers for not growing cotton and potatoes and wheat in an attempt to create a government-controlled cartel for farmers. So all these agricultural products that he mentions were actually monopolistic at the time because of U.S. government farm policy. And so there was a double lie that generations of students were taught, that these are all the ideal, these are markets, when they weren't. They were the ideal monopoly because of government intervention. And so and as I said, that really ruled the roost, Hans Samuelson's book. By the time you get to the 1980s, though, there were some other books that really took huge market share away from Samuelson because of all the failures of government. The one by Gortney and Stroop was probably the best seller. It eclipsed Samuelson for several years in the 1980s as a number one selling economics textbook. Okay, and so if we look at these assumptions, the way Austrians have criticized this theory, and it has had very important public policy consequences of this bad theory, because eventually policymakers came to take these assumptions seriously as what competition should look like, and the conclusion was, well, government should force the economy to have more homogeneous products, homogeneous prices, many firms rather than few firms, and so forth. Look at assumption number one, the many firms. The problem in theory is that fewer firms. If we have fewer firms, that's a bad thing. This was the thinking from the 1930s until about the 1980s by almost the entire economics profession, but again, not the Austrians.
And the question is, well, what causes an industry to become more concentrated? Economists invented something called concentration ratios to measure a monopoly. For example, a four-firm concentration ratio would be the a measure of the percentage of sales in an industry that the four largest firms account for in terms of sales. And economists picked a magic number of 60%. If the four-firm concentration ratio came to be 60%, that was said to be sort of the litmus test for monopoly somehow. It wasn't 61% or 59%, it was 60%. And the antitrust regulators used that for decades as a rule of thumb for which industries to investigate for possible monopoly. And for example, General Motors for years and years instructed its management, this was before the Japanese and the Germans entered the American market in a big way after World War II. For quite a few years, the American car companies had they were the only ones around, the big three, until Toyota and Mitsubishi and the rest really made inroads in the 1960s and 70s. But before that, General Motors management instructed all of its employees to make sure that they never had more than a 40% market share, because if they ever had more than a 40% market share, they were sure they would be sued by the government for being monopolistic, and even if they got that market share by producing great cars at low prices. And so that's how extreme this was, and it had these bad effects of actually encouraging companies like General Motors to not compete too much for fear of being harassed by the government. You know, once the government gets a hold of you, which IBM found, IBM was sued in the 1960s because it had a large market share of computers, and the lawsuit went on until 1982 when the judge died. And you know, if any of you have any knowledge of the legal system, I've been an expert witness in a few and worked for some law firms, and the first thing the law firm does is send me big boxes full of paper that I'm supposed to memorize, so I know all the facts of this case, and that presumably the judge has to do that too. So you have litigation going on for 15 years or something like that, and the judge and all the lawyers and the witnesses are all supposed to be up in all this, and the judge dies. Well, what happens, you get a new judge if you want to continue this, but you have to wait until that judge gets up to speed on all that has happened in this time. So the antitrust division of the Justice Department and the Reagan administration just said, forget about it. And so, but in the meantime, IBM spent many, many millions of dollars and probably many millions of hours of management time focusing on this antitrust lawsuit rather than producing better computers. And by that time, Microsoft had totally eclipsed IBM anyway. And the antitrust lawsuit probably had a lot to do with Microsoft's success, because it was really a hindrance to their ability to compete. And to show you how ridiculous it sometimes got by taking this many firms assumption so seriously, is back in the 1930s, the Alcoa Company was extremely successful, the Aluminum Company of America, and it had a big market share. And therefore, it was sued by the federal government. And there was a judge, he's pretty famous in Supreme Court history. His name is Learned Hand. If I was a judge, that's a name I would pick for myself. Judge Learned Hand. The opposite of Stupid Hand, Learned Hand. And he's generally praised as being a pretty good Supreme Court justice, but in the Alcoa case, they were found guilty of being a monopoly. And here's what Learned Hand said. He condemned them. This is his statement, condemning them as a monopoly and finding them guilty of violating the antitrust laws. He condemned Alcoa for its, quote, superior skill, foresight, and industry, end quote, because this was, quote, exclusionary, end quote. Yes, it excluded other aluminum companies that were less skillful and had less products. And he said further, he said, what did they do that was so bad? They, quote, efficiently supplied a demand that had evolved, that the demand somehow evolved for aluminum. And he said, worse yet, they had correctly, correctly anticipated increases in customer demand and then doubled and redoubled their capacity to fill the demand and they embraced every new opportunity with a great organization manned with elite business personnel, end quote. And that was unfair and exclusionary because the other companies did not have elite business personnel. And so this was sort of egalitarian insanity run amok. But of course, the shareholders of Alcoa and the customers of Alcoa who bought aluminum to manufacture products were all... I'll take questions at the end unless you... Well, I was reading from the actual statement, but this is which I quoted in my own book, How Capitalism Saved America, which I'll sell to you in autographed form downstairs if you want to. But it's from his actual Supreme Court decision. Back in 1937 was when they filed the lawsuit against Alcoa. And so this is not just a theoretical curiosity. This has created huge problems for the U.S. economy. And why do industries become more concentrated? Well, as I read earlier, as the older economists knew at the late 19th century, economies of scale is a major reason. Companies that achieve low cost per unit cost production before their competitors do, well, of course, they can underprice their competitors and they gain a bigger market share. There's also, for years, there was a domino theory of mergers. That said that, well, this is a bad thing. Two companies will merge, and those two companies merging will encourage other companies within an industry, within a particular industry, to merger also. And there's a domino effect. You might have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 mergers. So you might have an industry where there were once 50 competitors, but after this domino effect, you might only have 10 competitors. And by definition, that's a bad thing according to the perfect competition model because there's fewer firms. But think about that just for a minute. If, say, you had 50 competitors in an industry, two of them merge, what would cause others to merge also? What would be the incentive? What would they think? Why should we look into a possible merger also? What's that? It sounded like the Tower of Babel, but correct. I'll just say correct. But the answer is, well, obviously what happened was the merger led to economies of scale, lower cost, and therefore the ability to underprice the other 48 companies. So the other 48 companies are thinking, well, if we're going to survive, we need to do something to compete. We'll imitate what these competitors just did, because they found some kind of synergy involved in the merger. And mergers don't always work out that way, but that's what happens. That's the kind of thinking that goes into this. And not all mergers work out as you know, something that can cut costs, but a great many of them do. And so when you see this domino effect of mergers, the end result was always lower cost and prices. And this was said to be worrisome because why? Well, it led to fewer firms. But from the consumer's perspective, it was all a good thing. Another thing that leads to fewer firms is corporate takeovers. And the standard sort of free market explanation of corporate takeovers has to do with the fact that if any company is undervalued, that is because the management is not earning as much profit as it could be earning, bad management, costs are higher than they could be, profit opportunities are being ignored. What a corporate takeover is a group of investors basically who think they can buy up enough shares in that company to control the board of directors, fire the existing management, run the company differently, and make more profit because they now are the owners of a huge chunk of shares. And so they have every incentive to do whatever they can to run the company better and increase profitability, because that's when their shares will be more valuable if they do that. It doesn't always work out that way. People are not omniscient as far as that goes. But that's what the takeover market is all about. That's what takeover specialists do, basically. That's why people like in the 1980s, T. Boone Pickens was a famous takeover specialist. He's been in the news recently for wanting to have the government help him build windmills. And I read recently that the Depression has caused him to say, maybe I'll forget about the windmills. And then he can't get enough credit to build all the windmills he wants. But he made his billions as a takeover specialist, as far as that goes. there was a corporate takeover wave in the 1980s, and people like him and Michael Milken made a lot of money putting together investors who could do just this, take over companies that are being, they thought, poorly run. And so, yes, it would result in fewer firms numerically within an industry, but that doesn't mean competition is diminished. In fact, this is called the market for corporate control. It's a market. It's competition. The takeover market provides competition for managers who might be satisfied to sit on their butts and not work too hard. And not only that, but to take excessive amounts of money out of the company for their own salaries and perks, et cetera, which is essentially stealing from shareholders, in a sense, when they do that. Whenever they do too much of that, takeovers can threaten that. And for the benefit of shareholders, by the way, people who have studied this, the shareholders of the acquired company typically make out by about 40% increase in their shares, and so it's a pretty good deal if this comes along. I used to show in my classes a PBS video. They had this Harvard law professor who was a very good moderator, and he had around a table. On one side was the foxes, and on the other side was the chickens. And the foxes were takeover specialists. T. Boone Pickens himself was there, and other people who had been involved in takeovers. And on this side, he had chief executive officers, the chickens, of various companies that had been targeted by takeovers. And he asks one of the CEOs, what would you do if Mr. Pickens here called you up and said, your company is in play? That is, we're buying up shares. There's a proxy fight going on. We're buying up shares to take over your company and get rid of you and your management. And the CEO said, well, I would immediately call a meeting of my board of directors, and we would figure out every way possible to cut our costs and increase our profits and, you know, get rid of divisions that weren't making money and use those resources for divisions that were making money. And then he went on and on and on. And what's the obvious question that goes begging there? Yeah, why wasn't he already doing this? Well, the competitive pressure of a takeover, or even the threat of a takeover, is one of the things that would cause him to do this. And if not, well, he'll be taken over. Yeah, and so as a lot of CEOs know this. They know that their job can be ended. They can be fired by takeover specialists. That's why they hated it. And during the 80s also, several dozen states passed laws that created new regulations, making corporate takeovers much more costly and difficult. And so these laws, these anti-takeover laws, were protectionist laws. They were protecting management from competition in the market for managers, and which is definitely anti-competitive. It's not takeovers that are anti-competitive. It's anti-takeover laws that are anti-competitive. But this all this thinking, though, comes from the basic belief that we should be suspicious of fewer firms. And the concentration ratios, by the way, that were adopted by the economics profession, they were always nonsensical, because for decades they became popular in the beginning around the 1930s and 40s in the field of industrial organization and among the antitrust regulators, but they ignored international competition. The four-firm concentration ratio in the automobile industry, for example, did not include Toyota or Mercedes. It was for only the big three, couldn't have been a four-firm in autos, I guess, the big three. But it ignored international competition. They also ignored potential competition. Any industry where there are above-average profits is going to invite competition from all over the world. But there's no way to measure that. There's no way to put a number on that and call it some kind of ratio, and so the economists just ignored it. There was a revolution in this area of economics in the 1970s and 80s. Now the Austrians never bought into this. Armentano's book that I put up on the board here earlier is a great exposition of the Austrian view of antitrust and monopoly. If anyone's really interested in this whole field, that's the book to read. He wrote also a small book, a pamphlet version of it, which is for sale downstairs also. And so I highly recommend that book. But there was a resurrection of common sense that's mostly associated with the Chicago School. And there were hundreds of studies done of different industries that had been harassed by antitrust regulation. And it came to be known as the new learning, which I always got a laugh out of, because it wasn't, there was nothing new about this at all. The Chicago schoolers rediscovered the type of thinking that I read to you at the very beginning of this lecture from the old 19th century economists who did not see any imminent danger in corporate mergers and in fewer firms, because they recognized that they were usually the result of efficiency, industrial concentration. And so a book that I would recommend if you're interested in this whole area here of the new learning is there's a book by a man named Yale Brozen, B-R-O-Z-E-N. It's called Concentration, Mergers, and Public Policy. And it was published in the 80s, but it's a big survey of all these empirical or statistical studies of the effects of industrial concentration from that time. I don't have time here to really explain much about how these studies were done. But in a nutshell, what they came to say is that industrial concentration is almost always the result of superior efficiency on the part of one or a few firms within an industry. Because the alternative explanation was, if there are fewer firms, it's easier for them to collude and conspire in some sort of price-fixing conspiracy and create a monopoly. That was always the implicit assumption. It was never proven. It was just assumed that if there are fewer firms, this is likely the cause of any higher profitability, collusion and monopoly pricing. What Armentano's book does is he went through the 55 biggest federal antitrust cases up to that time in history, and he found that in every single case, the firms that were sued for violating the antitrust laws were dropping prices, expanding output, innovating, creating new products. They were doing the opposite of what neoclassical economics says monopolies do. Not what Austrians say monopolies do, but what the standard neoclassical theory says they do. But so this did end a lot of the craziness. There was sort of a respite for about 15 years in antitrust regulation, where it got a lot more sensible. But now the bad guys are back. Beginning about with Daddy Bush, the first Bush administration put some new antitrust regulators in that sort of ignored all of this, and we're proceeding like that now in government. Okay, assumption number two about homogeneous products. This has been taken way too seriously also, and I can give you an example of another famous antitrust case. We economists who have studied this call it the cereals case, as in breakfast cereal. And the cereals case had to do with General Mills, General Foods, and Kellogg's started experimenting, producing many different kinds of dry cereal in the 1970s. Prior to that, they had Corn Flakes and a few others. It wasn't like today, where you go to a grocery store and there's hundreds of different kinds of cereals. That wasn't always like that. And so at the beginning of this, making it the way it is now, these companies experimented. They did a lot of marketing research, and they created a whole bunch of new brands that really caught on with customers. So as a result, these three companies had 70% of the market for dry cereal, the cereal that you put milk in the morning for breakfast. And so naturally, they were sued by the government. And there was no theory that the government had that they could rely on to justify the lawsuit. So they hired an economist from Harvard named Friedrich Scherer, who at the time had a big selling textbook in the field of industrial organization. And he invented a new theory to justify the lawsuit. He called it a theory of shared monopoly, where these three companies are said to share a monopoly. And the tactic they used was brand proliferation. Not brand, but brand with a D on it, brand proliferation. And so the assumption was that 70% market share equals monopoly. How did that come about? Brand proliferation. Lots of different brands. And So again, these three companies were dragged through the mud and at the cost of many millions of dollars and untold numbers of hours of people spending time dealing with the government, giving the government paperwork and so forth, rather than managing the cereal companies. But eventually, the judge in the case threw it out. So the cereal companies won, but you never win when you're sued by the government for antitrust, because it's going to cost you a lot of money even if you win the actual court case. And I don't have the exact statement here, but one of the statements the judge made is very memorable. He made the comment that, well, I don't like dry cereal. I eat bacon and eggs in the morning. And his point was a good one, that there are a lot of substitutes for dry cereal. You know, even if they were able to drive up the price of dry cereal by 50%, well, then you eat oatmeal for breakfast or bagels, or, you know. And so these, the Harvard economists that were making $1,000 an hour probably as consultants on this were just pretty much made to look like idiots by this clever judge. And so, but again, that's, you multiply that by thousands of lawsuits around the United States. Most antitrust lawsuits are private lawsuits. They're not the big headline gathering federal government lawsuits. They're mostly private, well over 90%. One company suing another. And now think about that. You know, the monopoly is supposed to be harmful to consumers because they raise prices. Okay. Now, if you're a competitor and one of your rivals is raising prices, is that good or bad for you? That's all good. Either you can raise your price too, if you know, depending where you are on your demand curve, you could possibly make more money, or you could keep your price where it is and watch all the business go to you and away from your customers. So why would you call in the government and say, my competitors are raising their prices, make them stop it immediately? That is the whole basis of antitrust regulation. When you see a private lawsuit, when you see one company bringing a lawsuit against another, they want that company to, that company is cutting prices, or it's innovating and it's coming up with newer products. It's taking business away from you. That's why you're getting you're filing a lawsuit. One of my MBA students is in the land development business. They build golf courses and housing developments. At least they did when there was still a market for such things. And he said it's just accepted to us that if we're going to build a golf course, we'll be sued under the antitrust laws by our competitors, because they'll say, well, there's only it'll be the only golf course within 10 miles. It's a monopoly. And so, and of course, the competitors don't intend to win necessarily these lawsuits, but it imposes costs on them. It imposes costs on my student's company, and that's the whole purpose of this sort of thing. And so, the Austrian view of product homogeneity is that, of course, product differentiation is always best thought of as a competitive device. Companies compete by constantly trying to figure out better ways to create products that consumers like. And here's an example. I don't know if we are able to darken this area or not. Well, this is the first conference we ever used this particular room. So the man in the sky there, his name is Chad. I can see a head in a hole in the wall in the ceiling. He'll figure it out for us. He's a genius at this stuff. But what this is, I have some statistics here from the annual report of the Dallas Fed from 1998, and you can go ahead and boo the Dallas Fed if you want. But what it, there are a couple of pretty good economists who work there, and the article here is about something called mass customization, the integration of manufacturing and computer technology, and how this resulted in a vast expansion in the variety of products of all kinds. You know, why would companies do this? Well, that's because they thought people would like this, just like the cereal companies. And if the people don't like it, well, then they'll lose money or go out of business. The ones who make the best guesses, the best estimates, will make money. But just a few examples. They compare the early 1970s to the late 1990s. There were 140 vehicle models in the early 70s, 260 by the late 90s. Websites, zero in the 1970s, you know, 4,757,000 some by the late 90s. New book titles, 40,000 versus 70,000 77,000. TV screen sizes, 5 versus 15. Even Pop-Tarts. There were only 3 brands of Pop-Tarts in the 1970s. 29 brands of Pop-Tarts. Soft drink brands, 20 in the 1970s, 87 by the late 90s. You know, on and on. Dental floss. One of them is beer. There were only 25 brands of beer in the U.S. in 1980. By 1998, there were 187 brands of beer. No, of course, I knew that'd be an applause line. Let's see. Houses of prostitution. They don't have that. They don't have that. Let's see. The only applause I got was beer, alcohol. But you get the message. Now, of course, a lot of these brands have gone bankrupt because, you know, business people are not geniuses. They don't have perfect foresight in what people want. But the whole thing is that they're struggling and competing to please the consumer. That's why we have this brand proliferation. And it's just, again, it's exactly the opposite of the thinking that went into the cereals case, which is not that long ago. And there's basically a basic error of economics that goes here. Now, this is what most of all of you have seen. This is just a monopoly diagram, standard neoclassical economics monopoly diagram from any textbook that has a chapter on monopoly. And the basic story is that in a constant cost industry like this, where the marginal average costs are a straight line, a monopoly will restrict output, it said. It'll produce less than if there's competition. So if I've written, you know, Q monopoly is the standard monopoly level of output, and Q competition is the level of output that would exist in competition. That's a standard textbook model. Now, what some of the thinking was behind people who want to regulate product innovation, like the cereals case, I want the government to regulate it more to avoid monopoly, is they look at this and say, some company that invents a new product that catches on will be a monopolist for a period of time. And now, if 1,000 people had the same idea at the same time, instantaneously, there would be many firms producing this product, and this would be the quantity of output. It would be competitive quantity of output. But that didn't happen. Only one firm had this idea. And therefore, they're a monopoly, and they're going to produce the monopoly level of output. Therefore, innovation and product differentiation create monopoly. And then the argument will go, therefore, the government needs to regulate innovation. There are two economists named Dennis Mueller and Keith Cowling who are very well-known industrial organization economists who about 20 years ago wrote a paper in one of the economics journals that got a lot of publicity, in which they argued for the creation of new congressional subcommittees that would regulate innovation because of this argument, that they thought too much innovation by corporations was creating monopolies everywhere. And this was at the onset of, you know, the high-tech revolution, all these software products that would be, you know, unique. And when the Palm Pilot was invented, there was no competition for a couple of weeks. And so you had the monopoly. And this is an example of what economists call the Nirvana fallacy. This phrase was coined by the economist Harold Demsetz, who was one of the Chicago School economists, by the way, who did a lot of this important research debunking the market concentration myths. And all of that research was very Austrian in that it looked at markets once again as being dynamic, and didn't worry about the fact that at any one point in time, one company is at the top. Well, one company is always at the top. There's always somebody who's the best in any industry. They're not necessarily a monopoly. They're just the best. But the Nirvana fallacy in this context, what it says is that we're comparing the real world, this company that invents a new product that people like, okay, with some sort of unrealistic, never attainable world of perfection where 1,000 people have the same idea at the same time. Perfectly competitive equilibrium. This is competitive equilibrium. Nirvana. It's heaven on earth where everyone has the same idea at the same equilibrium. And so what someone like Demsetz would say is that we're making the wrong comparison here. We're comparing the real-world level of output, Q monopoly, to Nirvana, and there's no such thing as Nirvana on Earth. The proper comparison is comparing Q monopoly to zero. After all, the inventor created something when there was nothing. So there's an expansion of product. There's not a restriction in product. It's an expansion of product. And so that's the kind of thinking that goes into that. I'll move the slide up.
Okay. Sure, I can do that. Too big to go all on.
I'll tell you what. I will give you this piece of paper when we're finished, if you want to. But you can find any textbook in the shelves there and look at the Monopoly chapter, and you'll find the exact same thing. So that's what the Nirvana fallacy is. In fact, the whole perfect competition model is one big Nirvana fallacy. Those assumptions, after all, are totally unrealistic. Another widely read book on antitrust is one by Robert Bork, the old judge, Robert Bork. It was called The Antitrust Paradox, published in the 1970s. And my favorite sentence in that book is he said, if the government actually tried to force perfectly competitive equilibrium on the economy, it would have roughly the same impact as several strategically placed nuclear explosions on the economy. Could you imagine if the government, you know, had the resources to do that? But thank goodness it doesn't. Okay. Assumption number three about perfect information, that has led to a lot of mischief also, perfect information. Why would anybody believe that this is a serious thing to take into consideration, that defining a market as only competitive if all consumers know everything and all producers know everything regarding how to produce at minimum cost to supply the customers? The Austrian view, of course, is that this information is exactly what markets reveal to us. You can't assume that some big head in the sky, like Chad up there, knows all of this and can centrally plan an economy and decide which industries are competitive, which are not. It's the market itself reveals to us this information. One example of this point is that there's a book by the same guy, Frederick Scherer, and he has a co-author named David Ravenscraft, and they published a book where they had data on, I think the number was something like several thousand corporate mergers in the United States, a very large sample. And they looked at them historically in terms of asking the question of, well, what happened to all these corporate mergers that took place in the United States over decades? Did these companies remain merged, or did some of them get spun off? Did they decide, well, this was a bad idea, it didn't work out, we'll get rid of the company we acquired, we'll sell it to somebody else? And they found that in about almost half of the time, within 10 years, the acquired company was sold off. So the merger didn't work out. And they conclude from that we need more government regulation of mergers, where smart guys like Frederick Scherer and David Ravenscraft should be able to advise the government on which mergers should go forth and which should not. But the Austrian view is that, well, the only way to find out which mergers are going to work and which aren't is to allow them to happen. And these companies did what they had to do. If it didn't work out, they didn't cut costs and or improve the quality of the product, make that new company more competitive, well, they changed their behavior. They spun off the acquired firm. And if you were to block that process altogether, we would never be able to learn what works and what doesn't. And so the implicit assumption there is that there is some sort of ability to have the knowledge on the part of people who have no financial stake in this merger. The government bureaucrats have no financial stake in these mergers. If you give them the power to decide which ones go forth and which ones don't, if they make bad decisions, there's no downside to them. You know, they get their pay raise next year and their escalation up into GS-18. Automatically, whether they make bad decisions or good decisions. And at the same time, if they make good decisions, there's no reward to them for making good decisions, allowing mergers to take place that end up reducing costs and prices. And so you create a very bad situation where you have no incentives on the part of the people to make the right decisions. But people who are putting their own money on the line do. And so if you allow these to go forth, people will make mistakes. People are not omniscient. But when you've got millions of dollars of your own money on the line, you certainly have the incentive to make the right decisions, okay, unlike the government bureaucrats that get involved in this. Okay, so that's the assumption about homogeneous products, or about that's my one point, rather, about perfect information. In a world of perfect information, what role is there for advertising? That's an easy question. If consumers already know everything, why advertise? It'd be a big waste of money. And so the mischief that's been caused by this assumption has been there have been all sorts of attacks or calls on advertising as wasteful. But of course, advertising is an essential part of competition. It's the way Israel Kirzner once put it was that you could have the best gasoline station in the world with the lowest prices, the best service, and so forth. But if it's located behind a row of tall pine trees and no one knows you're there, what good is it? You know, you're not going to be able to compete. So you have to let people know, where you are. And in terms of the effects of advertising, it's just like corporate takeovers. It's government bans on advertising that are anti-competitive. One clear example that I've been using for years in my classrooms is how some years ago the Holiday Inn hotel chain joined forces with some environmentalist groups to try to put restrictions or outright bans on roadside advertising on the interstates, because the Sierra Club said it's ugly. You know, you're driving down the interstate and you see the beautiful kudzu, and then all of a sudden there's a big sign that says Motel 6, 1995, and it's a blight. And of course, ask yourself, do you think the Holiday Inns was being public-spirited and interested only in the beauty of the environment and of the kudzu on Interstate 85, or might they have some ulterior motive, like preventing Motel 6 from advertising that you can get a hotel room for only $20 compared to the $80 you'd have to pay at the Holiday Inn? Well, clearly they had a motivation to ban the competitors' advertising. If you're traveling down Interstate 85, you've been driving for 8 hours, everybody knows that Holiday Inn has a brand name. You know what you're going to get. You know you get a decent room, not too many roaches. You'll get a swimming pool with a bunch of little kids peeing in it, some stale donuts, and if you're lucky, a lounge singer, all for $80. But if all you want is a clean bed and a shower and then get back on the road, 1995, Motel 6 is a good deal. And so, but if you can ban that, you wouldn't know that the Motel 6 is there. It would be Israel Kirzner's gas station. It'd be behind the row of pine trees, and you don't even know it's there. It could be the cleanest hotel on the planet. How would you know to pull over on exit 92 and go there instead of Holiday Inn? And so it's restrictions on advertising that are likely to cause monopoly power, and not advertising itself. One other thing, part of the standard neoclassical story on monopoly is that, well, monopolists restrict output. That's what the monopoly diagrams, that's what's bad. Murray Rothbard's take on this was that he thought that economists who are always harping on consumer sovereignty really should think of it in terms of individual sovereignty. Because after all, if I'm a business person and I innovate and create a new product, for example, and if I do have monopoly power for a short amount of time, where is it written in the Bible that my rights of my property are not worth as much as your rights as a consumer? You know, where is it written that you have always have as a consumer always have the right to have the government interfere and take my property from me or prohibit me from charging whatever price I want to charge? If you think of individual sovereignty, well, then the seller has as much of a right to sell at whatever price he or she thinks they can get as you have to try to get the best price for you. And that's one thing. And also, the whole business of output restriction being the bad thing about monopoly, when you think about it, it gets kind of absurd. When I was a college student, I was a big Muhammad Ali boxing fan. But now it's Ultimate Fighting. They don't box anymore. It's Ultimate Fighting. You know, how often do those guys fight anyway? Who knows? About in the course of a year, how often do they have an ultimate fight competition? What's that? Three or four? Okay, well, they're obviously restricting competition, restricting output, aren't they? Because if you ever saw that movie Fight Club, those guys fought every night. You know, that Brad Pitt, when he got his face all beaten in that club. you know, that would be more like perfect competition to fight every night. So, you know, why shouldn't the government force these ultimate fighters to go out there every night and beat each other's brains in? That would be closer to perfect competition. And you could think of anything. In fact, in the real world, I was at a conference once on antitrust where there was a guy from the Federal Trade Commission was bragging about how they're protecting us consumers. And he said they were in Detroit at the time, and they noticed that in the winter months, all the car dealers in Detroit closed up in downtown Detroit at about 5 p.m. And, you know, I've been to Detroit once or twice, but I imagine in the dark, at night, after business hours, in the winter in Detroit, there's not a lot of people out shopping for cars on weeknights. And so, you know, I would think it would be economical for the car companies not to be open up for business. And they were considering forcing these companies to stay open until 9 o'clock at night because they were suspecting they were colluding and restricting output by closing up at 5 o'clock. And I asked them, does that mean that economic efficiency requires forced labor? Because what else would it be if you tell people, you know, we'll put you in jail if you don't go and work. That's forced labor, or we'll fine you. And he had no answer to that, because the answer obviously was yes. That's what they were saying. Forced labor is required for competitive equilibrium to be efficient. And so when you think about this, it really gets kind of absurd, is this restriction of output. And I guess the final thing I'll say is that government has always been the creator of monopoly. I've given you examples of how antitrust itself has created monopoly, but the Interstate Commerce Commission created a government-run cartel for the trucking and railroad industries for almost 100 years in the United States. The Civil Aeronautics Board was a government-run cartel for the airline industry. There were more airlines in America in the 1920s than there were in the 1970s because of this government regulation. AT&T became a telephone monopoly because during World War I, the government nationalized the telephone industry. And then after World War I, it set up a system where each state would have a monopoly in the telephone business and would use only AT&T. So this was not a free market monopoly. Cable television was a monopoly for decades. Why? Because local governments gave monopoly franchises to individual companies and created government-created monopolies. Protectionism creates monopoly power. It's government regulation that creates monopoly. It's not the free market that creates monopoly. The free market is the antidote to monopoly, but we have a large body of economic theory that says up is down, black is white, smart is stupid, and on and on and on, by claiming that monopoly comes from the free market and we need government regulation to correct it. But whenever you hear that we need government regulation to prevent monopoly, hold on to your wallet, because historically what has inevitably happened is that regulation will eventually be controlled by the companies that are supposedly being regulated by the regulators, and they are going to act in their interest and not your interest. That's been the whole history. And I guess my time is up because the ominous Mark Thornton is standing up over there. Thank you.